This is the Oscar Podcast. Podcast. I'm here with Craig Kennedy from livingincinema.com and Ryan Adams and myself from awardsdaily.com. Ugh, I have to do that. Hi, welcome to episode 5 of Oscar Podcast. My name is Sasha Stone from Awards Daily, and I'm here with Ryan Adams, also from Awards Daily, and Craig Kennedy from livingincinema.com. And today we're going to talk a little bit about the Best Picture race again. And we're going to dive into Best Actress, Best Supporting Actress, because there are some performances that we don't know what category they're going to fall under. And then, since it's close to election time, we're going to talk a little bit about the election and how that's impacting the Oscar race, this very contentious year. And we'll also close with some suggestions of possibly horror movies to watch over Halloween, which is coming up on Wednesday. Okay, so we'll start with Best Picture. Right now, it still looks like it's Argo's to lose. Ben Affleck's movie has made a whole shitload of money. It's right in the mid-50s, $50 million or so, before this weekend comes to a close. It should hit $100 million, no problem. It's really well-reviewed. The word of mouth is great. And, you know, it's about Hollywood. It's about America. It's about a hero. It's the best-reviewed mainstream Hollywood film of the year. And I'm still going to say that its main competition is Lincoln, Steven Spielberg's Abraham Lincoln biopic, which just hit the cover of Time magazine with two different covers. One said Daniel Day-Lewis, world's greatest actor, and the other said, what would Lincoln do?
I think one is the international cover and one is the domestic cover, or am I misunderstanding that? That's the impression that I got.
Oh, I didn't know. I don't know.
Which is the one that, did you buy it on the newsstand, the one with the world's greatest actor? Did you get that on the newsstand?
No, I got it on Facebook, on the Lincoln page on Facebook.
I think that may be the international cover. I get it in the mail, and so the issue that came in the mail today is the one, what would Lincoln do?
Oh, okay. So it's not world's greatest actor. Well, what would Lincoln do is a really good question, and we'll talk a little bit more about that when we talk about the election. It's a very pointed question, I think, and a rhetorical question, if you ask me. So basically that's how the Best Picture race is looking right now. It's really those two movies, and then you have Silver Linings Playbook is also very much in play, and Life of Pi, that's four movies, and everybody's expecting Les Mis to do really well, and Zero Dark Thirty, and then possibly The Hobbit. I'm still holding out hope that Beasts of the Southern Wild and Moonrise Kingdom will also be recognized. They're smaller movies, of course, but they're both really well-reviewed. Moonrise Kingdom made a whole bunch of money, and it's Wes Anderson's best film, in my opinion, and I think it should do pretty well on the Oscar race. And those, for me, are the movies I think are the strongest right now for Best Picture. What about you guys? Do you think you agree? Or
I agree with all those. I would say on the cusp. I hate to give up on The Master. It did get incredibly high scores from critics, and I know that it hasn't made a lot of money, and it has some controversy around it, recent remarks by Joaquin Phoenix and everything that we discussed last week, but I'm still not ready to give up on it yet. There are other movies that I wish would be on the cusp, but I think it's probably more of a wishful thinking to expect that a movie like Cloud Atlas would make it into the Best Picture.
I know.
I love, as much as I love it, it's just too out there.
It's too out there.
Yeah, I think that was probably going to be a long shot to begin with, and now the fact that the critics have taken a big crap all over it and the audience has stayed away in droves is going to make it really hard, I think, for it to climb that hill.
Right. I agree with you. The Master is an interesting subject. I feel like right now it's kind of on the fence. It only made $15 million. It's being held up by the reviews, and it's not loved unanimously the way that There Will Be Blood is.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not sure how that movie's going to fall. I know that Weinstein Co. has Django Unchained coming, and that movie looks really good so far. I mean, it's not, obviously, we haven't seen the movie. I don't think Tarantino's ever really made a bad movie. His worst movies are better than most of the other movies you see out. So if I had to pick, I think I would say Django Unchained will probably take the Master spot. If Django Unchained is terrible, if it's his worst movie ever, then they could start looking at The Master again. However, think about how many people are going to pick The Master as their number one movie. Is it going to be enough? It's a tough one.
Should we be considering, do we even want to discuss this? It's really hard to predict because these always come out of left field. The movie that everyone is the head scratcher every year, that people are surprised it got nominated at all, they're usually a little more, let's say, middle brow. Mm-hmm.
The Help.
The Help or The Blind Side or even Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close.
Right.
Although it had a great pedigree, it was a little bit. You know, it's aimed at a certain target audience that is older. You know,
right.
I could see the best exotic Marigold Hotel slipping in under those terms, and I don't mean that to say that it's middling. It kind of is, but I don't mean that as a criticism. But I think it appeals to a certain segment of the audience that seems to be right up Oscar's alley, namely people like my mother.
Right.
And it's a feel-goody movie.
Right.
Let's talk a little bit about the Best Exotic Marigold Hotel. So this movie came out pretty early in the year, and it was written off because it came out so early in the year. And a lot of times if a movie's released, before Oscar season, it's people don't take it as seriously. But what happened with this movie was it found an unexpected audience. It started making a lot of money. And so then people started to look at it. Well, wait a minute. What's up with this movie? You know, why is it suddenly doing so well at the box office? It ended up making $46 million, which is pretty darn good for just a little movie that barely cost anything to make.
Almost another $90 million overseas.
Yeah, and it only cost $10 million. So this is your typical. I mean, if Weinstein Co. was handling this, it would be huge. But it's just as well because it's Fox Searchlight, and they're almost as good. Now, their other movies are Beasts of the Southern Wild, Life of Pi, and Hitchcock. So some people, like Chris Tapley, are predicting Hitchcock to get in, and I'll be seeing that. I'll be seeing that at the beginning of next week. So I'll be able to tell if it's.
Can I say something about the box office for Best Exotic Marigold? Mm-hmm. If I'm not mistaken, I believe that it came out the weekend of Mother's Day. And if you guys remember the previews they were showing on TV, the promos they were showing on TV, in the movie, maybe the word mother is mentioned four or five times throughout the entire movie. They managed to put all of those mentions of mother into the promo for TV promo for Mother's Day weekend. So people had the impression this is the movie to take your mom to.
That's great, but I also have to say, while watching it, and I have to fess up to the fact that I actually took a nap in the middle. But I think I caught enough of it to see. I got to rewatch it. I have a 24-hour rental on it, and I'm going to rewatch the whole thing. But what I saw was real characters, organic, actual real characters of women who didn't have plastic surgery to hide their age. Really strong performances by those women and by Bill Nighy, I think, was really good. And Judi Dench was great in the lead. And Tom Wilkinson was great. And Maggie Smith is hilarious in it. I have to watch it again. So please don't tell me she dies of cancer and I'm saying she's hilarious.
Did you see the subplot that involved Tom Wilkinson? Did you see where that was going? Did you see what happened with that?
I think he turned out to be gay, right?
Yeah, not only that, but he was there to look for. I don't guess it's a spoiler. Maybe a spoiler. No, I don't think it is because it's revealed pretty early in the movie. The reason he goes to India is to search for a guy that he was involved with when he was much younger, like teenager.
Does he find him?
That's more of a spoiler.
Okay.
But I guess.
I didn't like the Dev Patel subplot. It kind of bugged me a little bit for some weird reason.
That got better too because it got a little more serious. He seemed less of a cartoon as he went along a little bit. And I kind of got the sense that his character, he was sort of playing a character himself to the English people. So he was sort of playing up his goofy Indian guy routine.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'll have to watch it again, but I liked how refreshing the notion of having a story, a romantic comedy about an older woman was. It wasn't, to me, a movie like Cocoon where they treat the old people as, you know, kind of cute, doddering old fools. Or, you know, a lot of times, you know, there's even a character in Cloud Atlas that's like that. But most of them aren't. But, you know, they treat older people, senior citizens, like children in movies. Like that they're so stupid and they're so kind of, they've gone back to being a child. But not in this movie. You know, those are all very smart thinking people who are really contemplating their lives, you know, when Bill Nighy leaves his wife to go and be with Judi Dench, and the wife says, you know, it never worked. And
now that's a spoiler. I have to say that's a spoiler.
Who cares? Nobody's going to watch it anyway.
Yeah. Okay. Right. It's been out since May, so if you haven't seen it by now, then you ought to know, people. You know.
Sorry.
So that's all right. No, I shouldn't even have mentioned it's a spoiler because how long it's been out.
No, I'm sure people. I'm going to get an angry tweet about that one. Why did you spoil that moment?
The only reason I mention it is because that's like you don't even realize that until like the very last 5 minutes of the movie.
Yeah, I feel like a lot of the movies that we're seeing right now are, I don't know if it's just because I'm projecting because I am like obsessed with death and my age and the end of everything. Real cheery conversation. But, you know, these movies seem to be like really meditating on the kind of the end of life, the Life of Pi, Cloud Atlas, and this one, surprisingly, Best Exotic Marigold Hotel, all seem to be sort of contemplating, you know, our mortality. And
it's a totally different movie, but I think you could put Amour in that same category.
And Amour. It was so brilliant when you brought that up. The two of them, you said Best Exotic Marigold Hotel and Amour could be like companion pieces. And you're so right about that.
Two totally different kinds of movies, and they both approach a similar subject, but from different angles. And more obviously is much, it's harder edged because it's looking at love from the negative side of it, the negative consequences of being in love. But it's so real that if you think about it for a minute, it beautifully illustrates what the relationship must have been like when they were younger and weren't staring at the end. Does that make sense?
Oh, sure.
Sure.
It's so hard for them at the end that speaks volumes about what it was like for them in their prime.
Yeah, absolutely. And it shows how much the thing about that couple that was so amazing was how much they loved to talk to each other. Mm-hmm. That was what he missed the most was having this life partner to talk to. That's how engaging and interesting she was as a person to him. You know, she wasn't just somebody who, you know, made his dinner.
What's interesting about that casting too, especially I'm sure for French audiences, is the lead actor and lead actress were the hot thing in the 60s. Both of them were very, very hot. And so you know what they were like when they were younger. You can imagine what their romance must have been like when they were younger.
Wow. Right? That's so great. So that's Trintignant is the guy, right? What's his name? And then she's Emmanuelle Riva. And that's a good entree to bring us to Best Actress because I feel like she's the one who's going to get the shaft, especially after seeing Judi Dench in this movie. I think Judi Dench has a really good shot at overtaking her spot.
It's interesting because I think Amour has the critics' love behind it. It's got more built-in integrity simply because the critics adored it, whereas Best Exotic Marigold Hotel, I think, was treated mostly patronizingly by critics. The ones that liked it always liked it with the qualification that it was, you know, a little bit cliched and full of some platitudes and a lot of the same stuff that they're saying about Cloud Atlas, actually, right. But that's another story. So, but I think more people are going to, in the end, will have ended up seeing Exotic Marigold Hotel, so I think that gets Dench sort of maybe a leg up.
Funnily enough, you're right. Best Exotic Marigold Hotel right now is 62 on Metacritic, and Cloud Atlas is like 55. So that, those are really low scores for both of those. Critics don't like movies that are, so literal. So straightforward and sincere. You know, if they're sincere.
Yes, exactly, and they pull the heartstrings in obvious ways.
Yeah,
unexpected ways, but once you feel it, you know that it's been done to you before. Although it's done really well, we should mention it's directed by John Madden, mm-hmm. so he knows what he's doing. There's no slouch, you know.
Yeah.
He's a pro. Everybody involved in this movie are top notch.
It's a crowd pleaser, though, and people use that phrase as a backhanded compliment.
Right.
Yeah.
And even in this case, it's true. It is pleasing to watch, and somehow people act like movies should be medicine or they're not any good.
Right. And there is a definite divide these days between critics and audiences, I've noticed. First of all, you have your mass entertainment movies that get panned by the critics and still make a whole shitload of money because those people aren't reading the critics. Then you have movies like this, which hit the senior citizens crowd, and maybe they will have seen the review in the New York Times for it, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not going to deter them from seeing a movie that stars all these great older actors, which is about, you know, finding a second life, which is what this movie's about. It's like she goes to India, Judi Dench. I mean, I can't believe that there's a movie actually about the inner life of a woman who's like in her 70s.
Who's widowed, suddenly widowed, and now she has to figure out what to do with the remaining years of her life.
And she's talking about a career. She's talking about having a job, you know, in her inner life. I mean, that is so rare.
In another country, of all things, to fly off and do it and start a new life in another country and start a career, like you said, when she's 70 or whatever.
So I feel like for the people, for ticket buyers, what do they care what critics think? You know, it's like it doesn't affect their lives at all what so-and-so at such-and-such thought of this movie, you know? They're going to see it for themselves because it's something so utterly unique. And then with Cloud Atlas, I found that, like, the people that I kind of complain about, the fanboy critics, they're the ones that embrace Cloud Atlas, whereas the older traditional critics, almost 100%, other than Ebert and Andrew O'Hare, panned it. And it was interesting to me because I feel like that movie in its own weird way, and this is only because of my daughter's experience watching it, you know, is sort of, you know, starting kind of a newer template of storytelling that is not traditional but isn't critic friendly, like say Holy Motors or I don't know, any David Lynch movie where it's like so obscure it means nothing, but that is somehow taken as deep by critics because they don't understand it. It challenges them because they see so many movies that they're tired of movies that make sense. They like the movies that don't make sense. Maybe. I don't know. I can't speak for
I think that the people who are attracted to see Cloud Atlas in the first place are really going to like it. I don't think anyone is going to go to Cloud Atlas by accident and think, what the fuck was that? I hate to think that that would happen to people, but I really do think that people know who the Wachowskis are. They even know maybe Tom Tykwer, and they know the reputation of these directors, and they know what they're getting into. They know that they're getting into something brainy and inventive and creatively bold and daring.
But I just wonder, from our perspective, do the critics matter anymore? Do they matter? Do they affect anything? Do they affect the Oscar race? Because Extremely Loud, which I think got like a 40 on Metacritic, became Best Picture. Does it affect public buying tickets? I think with Cloud Atlas, it definitely has. But beyond that, what does it mean, really? What do critics mean? What is their place in our world?
I'm not so sure that the critics is what has hurt Cloud Atlas. I think that it just looked like a very difficult thing to get into. I just don't think that it looked attractive to that many people. I think the marketing, which was not dishonest marketing, it made it very clear this was going to be a very strange movie.
But
and I think
terrible,
that a lot of people are just not
reviews,
drawn to that.
But it got terrible reviews in NPR, LA Times, New York Times. You know, all the like mainstream reviewers panned it.
Right.
Yeah, but I don't think reviews can really make or break an opening weekend. I think opening weekend is all about the sales job that was done on it. And this movie, I think, because I mean, I think people who read reviews aren't necessarily the people who show up opening weekend to a movie. They're more going to wait until the crowds die down a little bit, I think. They're a little more thoughtful about their approach, whereas people that just go see whatever looks cool are going based on the trailers and based on their experience. And I think the failure, opening weekend failure of a movie like this basically just tells Hollywood that it's right for continuing to make sequels and remakes and comic book movies and things that seem like something else. This movie, you couldn't say that it looked like anything, for better or for worse, you couldn't say that it looked like anything that anybody had really seen before. And I think people just weren't comfortable taking a chance on it en masse.
That's a really good point. That's a really, really good point that you're right. It is going to confirm. I think that's what Ann Thompson was trying to say on Twitter. Like she said, the poor box. And by the way, we should note that poor box office only means it came in third. You know,
it may come in second. They're saying now that it may come in second. Which,
so that's not that bad.
Yeah.
You know, but I mean, I don't think it's going to make back its $100 million.
Not in the theaters, maybe. Or maybe, I'm not sure what it'll do worldwide. It's hard to predict with the sci-fi.
I was going to say, it could do well overseas. You can never tell about these kind of things.
Well, when I saw it at the premiere, I was noting, because we had to sit way in the back, which was annoying because there was lights coming in everywhere and people kept getting up. I noticed that the crowd was very restless for the first hour. And there were walkouts and people weren't. But after the hour kicked, and then the second part kicks in when it just becomes really moving and romantic at the end, they were riveted. You know, the audience was actually riveted to the screen. And I was surprised by that because I thought that it would have tuned a lot of people out. But I think if you hang with it, if you hang in there and you get past the confusing, annoying, kitschy, irritating part of it, you can find the joyful part of it.
You know, the interesting thing happened when I saw it yesterday with a friend. The screening we went to, this has never happened to me in this theater before, but the projector, I don't guess it was a film projector, but the projection broke in the middle, about an hour into it. So we had an intermission. It wasn't just our theater, it was all the theaters up and down, all through the multiplex. All the feeds broke for all the movies. Oh, everyone was milling around in the hallways. Everyone's taking a bathroom break and going to the concession stand because everybody's movie broke at the same time.
Wow.
And they said it would be ready. They have it back in about 15 minutes and they would be rewinding it so that we wouldn't miss anything. And so, I was able to hear people's reaction halfway through the movie. It was like having an intermission. And you and the audience, you could hear what people were saying sitting around you, who ordinarily you would never get a chance to overhear what people's opinion were because you're leaving the movie, the end of the movie and everything, right? So anyway, people were saying, I heard some people say, like, I wish they would rewind it all the way to the beginning. Now that I'm getting the hang of it, I want to see it over again from the beginning now that I can understand the dialect and this and that, and now that I understand what's happening. People were really into it. So I was, and these were it was a surprisingly, like, older crowd. I live in a college town, so there's a lot of college professor types that go to movies like this on opening day. And that's what this crowd was like. It was a lot of college professor types at the screening, and they were really, really into it. I was impressed.
Wow. You know, Craig, I never asked you what you thought of it.
I loved it. The first 45 minutes or so, I just kind of, maybe it was from having talked to you and Emma about it the week before, I sort of was expecting it to be a little confusing at the beginning. So rather than, you know, struggling really hard to try and connect all the dots, I just kind of sat there and received it and just kind of let the movie do what it was going to do. And then after about 45 minutes, as soon as there's one or two connections between the different narrative threads, it starts to click and it just builds and it builds and it builds. And it just kind of ultimately becomes sort of emotionally overwhelming, this sense of connection between everything. And not necessarily even in a, it doesn't have to be a fruity metaphysical, you know, way. You don't have to believe in karma or reincarnation to understand this concept of things being connected. It's literally people's actions having consequences that sort of echo throughout history. And I just thought it was sort of beautiful and remarkable.
Wow, Craig. For some reason I thought you weren't going to like it. I'm so happy to hear that you did. Can't wait to
I wasn't sure if I was going to either, but I hadn't. But I knew enough. I knew that I wanted to, so I avoided all the trailers. I didn't see any of the trailers, which I heard were a little weird and kind of cheesy looking. Is that right? That's what I'd heard from people talking about it.
I don't know. I have a hard time criticizing it only because the score, you guys, is so overwhelming that whenever I think about the movie, I tend to just kind of swoon, you know, because of the music.
Me too. And I think also because the music plays an integral part in the plot, some of the plot points of the movie.
Yeah.
I believe that's going to appeal to people who write music. I think that's going to make it easier to nominate.
The movie plays kind of like music, too. I mean, the different mm-hmm. stories all play out like little themes, and at first they seem like separate, disjointed themes, but as the symphony goes along, they start to play together, and but by the end of it, it's all like all in one voice, and it's just mm-hmm. kind of spectacular, and that's so wonderful that you know, the whole idea of composing a score was part of that, and then the score itself on top of that, it was like this multi-layered thing.
Seriously, this is the kind of movie that the Oscars were made for. It's too bad that they will be so prejudiced against it, because Ryan, you were saying how it's not the book, but how could you make the book into a movie anyway? And so wouldn't you think that the adaptation of this would get Oscar attention, that the score would get Oscar attention, that the clever casting would somehow be recognized? I mean, to me,
screenplay.
Like, in the screen.
Yeah, I would, yeah, exactly. I think
notice?
That Sasha said that. But I think that you're right, because it would seem like that it would be unlikely to adapt it in the way that it in the format that it was in the book, because it would be too episodic. It would be too, because the stories in the novel are told more intact. Each story is told intact and breaks halfway through and then comes back after a cliffhanger and you find out how the story ends. It's not all woven together like that. So that's a very important thing to make it more cinematic. It's a really clever way.
It seems like, to be truly faithful to the book, it would have had to have been about 12 hours long. They had to make some compromises in order to make what turned out to be an almost 3-hour movie as it was. And I haven't read the book, but I can't imagine them having done a better adaptation within the constraints that they had.
Yeah. See, in the book, I'll just briefly, in the book, it starts out, the first 50 or 75 pages, you're in 1850. The next 50 or 75 pages, you flash forward to 1934, to the composer's story. Then for another 50 or 75 pages, you're in 1974. So it's big blocks of story.
Wow.
Like that.
Really?
The story is intact for big blocks of time. But then each story, just as each story, as you're getting into the groove of the new style, the story breaks in the middle at some a momentous moment, you know, just when you're thinking, oh, what's going to happen next? The story breaks and goes, it flashes forward for 40 or 50 or sometimes 500 years.
Does it do the same neo-soul? Was that in the book?
Mm-hmm. It's all in the book. It's just,
wow.
But it's not all broken up into pieces. Like you said, the movie makes it seem like that it's possible that all these things are happening almost simultaneously.
Yeah.
That all these different realities are different layers of the same reality. The book makes it much more chronological.
Oh, that's so interesting. You know, by the way, Emma's making me go see it tomorrow, which I don't mind. It'll be the third time I've seen it, but she really wants to go, so we're going to go again.
Good. It's the kind of movie that I think the two or three times, probably, you really have to see it that many times to grasp everything.
I know, and I feel that way about The Master, too. The Master, to me, was one of the most visually impressive films I've ever seen, and I didn't mind how dark it was. Cloud Atlas is such an emotional experience to watch it. I mean, I was crying. I didn't expect that the story that moved me the most the second time I saw it was the Sixsmith love story.
What I would recommend, since the book is written the way that it is, you can really read it as a book of six different short stories. And you don't have to read all of the short stories. If you don't feel like reading the entire novel, you can go to the novel and just read the Sixsmith story.
Oh,
you can just
wow.
read that. It comes second. It's the second section of the book. So you can read the first half of that and then skip later on in the book when it picks up the second half of it. And you can read that. Remember, I told you that it reminded me of something that Evelyn Waugh or Oscar Wilde might have written in the 1930s.
Yeah.
It's that sort of style, a little bit arch. It's not the book was made a little more, had more humor in that section of the story, which was okay that they eliminated that. But there's so many things that you'll appreciate in the movie that they put in the movie for people who have read the book that they don't explain very well. For instance, the scene where all the plates are they're crashing all the china in that shop.
That. Yeah.
You wonder, what the hell is that about? In the it's that's the first, I think it's maybe the first page of the Sixsmith story. They are in a China shop, and they decide, they wonder what, how, they're making music. They're making music with their broken plates. They enjoy the sound of the music, how musical it sounds.
Oh, wow. Wow, that's so,
and so
great.
And so that's not even explained at all in the movie. They don't even make an attempt to explain it, I don't think.
Seems like the rare case where you can watch the movie first and then read the book after and still have the book be just as rewarding as it may have been if you'd read it first.
Right.
I think so. I think it may even be better. I kind of regret what I was found myself. I kept looking for things, favorite parts of the book that I wanted to be shown in the movie. And so I spent a lot of time in the first half an hour really disoriented that it was so different. And I wish in a way that I was unprepared for it.
Yeah.
I think it's better to see the movie first.
I was so dazzled by it. I don't understand the critics not getting it to me. And I had a sort of an epiphany tonight as I was watching. Something I was watching came off, and then Harry Potter came on. Some Harry Potter, one of the Harry Potters. And I thought, you know, this is interesting because my daughter grew up watching these kind of Harry Potter movies and Lord of the Rings movies and, you know, the kind of whatever. She's online, so she's living these weird kind of online identities and all this stuff. And her life is so different from somebody like Kenneth Turan's life. Mm. And so, you know, she's obviously more open to a story like Cloud Atlas, but I just have this weird feeling that, like, the storytelling is evolving in a way that the critics, the mainstream critics, can't keep up with. I know it's controversial to say that, but I sort of felt like, after the way they responded to Cloud Atlas, that there was some tradition that they're holding on to that is now outmoded suddenly. And it just really struck me this time. I'm not saying they're wrong. They obviously have a right to feel that way. It's not a universal thing that people would think it's a good movie. But to not even have their minds cracked open a little bit to get what is so great about it.
I wouldn't even be shy about saying it because, I mean, if Rex Reed, when he saw Inception, famously said, "Will somebody please explain this movie to me?" When, I mean, most of us can really get it. We understand what it's about. Anybody who's had a background in movies and that type of story understand the structure and the themes behind it. You don't have to have somebody explain it to you.
Yeah.
It might not all fit together on the first viewing, but you know what? You're not lost. You're not lost in Inception at all. It really guides you along really clearly.
And also the fact that he's doing something innovative. It's like, it goes back to what Craig was saying about the sequels. It's like they all complain about how Hollywood is all about the safe bet. It's all about the guaranteed opening weekend $200 million sequel to whatever, Iron Man, The Avengers. Mm-hmm. And here are these filmmakers like Christopher Nolan, like the Wachowskis and Tom Tykwer, whatever you ever say his name, mm-hmm. And even the guy who made John Carter. You know, they're trying mm-hmm. to do something different. They're trying to breathe new life into Hollywood movies that's going to make people want to come to the movies and buy a ticket, you know. I just don't get where the critics don't get how special and important that is. You know, I just don't understand that. So I'm wondering
how daring it is and how risky and how we should be supporting these artists for taking the chance to do this, to go out on a limb and do this kind of exploration, and they don't give them credit for it.
So
I think if there was a different name above the title, that it might be received differently. I mean, if it were a Terrence Malick film, I think that maybe people would have gone for it more. And yeah. I don't bring that up facetiously completely because, to me, Cloud Atlas was really addressing a lot of the same big issues that The Tree of Life did in terms of people trying to find their place in the universe or to figure out the significance of their one tiny little life in the face of sort of an infinite universe. And the fact that this was done by the people that made The Matrix somehow makes people not want to take it as seriously. Whereas if it comes from somebody who comes with pre-established art house credibility, then everybody goes the extra mile to try and be as smart as the movie. But they didn't bother to try and do that here.
So true. And I really feel like it's coming out of the 60s way that we viewed art house avant-garde cinema. And I feel like that's still has its place. It still has value. But I worry that the critics of today aren't evolving and evolving as human beings. Rex Reed, forget it. He's done. He's finished. Right. Stick a fork in him. He should not be allowed to review movies.
He's to be read for entertainment purposes only.
He really shouldn't
be allowed to review movies like this, for sure. He should be restricted to the kinds of movies about whose opinion we break there. Never mind. That's such a stupid sentence.
But I used to really criticize and go after online critics for so long, and I've always said, mainstream critics are the only valuable word on it. But you know what? This time, this Cloud Atlas experience has made me rethink that, because those guys are the ones and girls who are open to this new kind of thing, you know, that the traditional critics simply aren't. They just, I even Bob Mondello, a guy on NPR who I absolutely love, who I always feel like he kind of gets it. But it seems like they're writing about a certain kind of structure, a certain kind of cinema that used to exist, but that is getting selected out because we have so many weird changes coming. We have streaming, home entertainment. We have, you know, weird little boxes, you know, cell phones and iPad minis or whatever that we're going to be watching all of our entertainment on. And things are changing so fast, but I feel like you have to change along with it and understand what those changes are. And I feel like this movie, because Lana Wachowski is a person who has made such a drastic, dramatic life change, and because it was so hard for her to do that publicly, and you know, I feel like there's so much in Cloud Atlas that speaks directly to that, but it also speaks to how we're changing as people too, you know, and how what's on the outside isn't necessarily who we are on the inside. I just loved how it crossed all sorts of lines, all sorts of barriers, sexual identity, racial identity, economic identity. It just sliced right through them. The guy who wrote the book was at the Q&A, and he said that when he thought of writing this book, he imagined a Russian dolls, you know, nesting dolls, and taking a screw and burrowing right through them to get, all the way through their lives to get, like, a sampling of each of the centuries. And, you know, when Halle Berry says, I don't understand why we keep making the same mistakes over and over again. And, you know, I don't know. Those big life questions, you know, these critics probably feel like, who are these people to answer or even ask these big life questions, you know? These aren't things that can be answered in a Hollywood movie by the guys who directed The Matrix. But yet, somehow, Cloud Atlas reaches so high that, to me, it seems crazy to not admire them for that, just for the reach alone.
And I will say, too, that even though Matrix 2 and Matrix 3 were disappointing, the Matrix itself was pretty groundbreaking and pretty philosophically deep. There have been entire books of essays collected about the Matrix. It's pretty brainy stuff going on in the Matrix.
They're wedging big questions and big ideas into popular entertainment, and I think it's the popular entertainment part that throws the snobby critics off a little bit, because it doesn't feel enough like taking your medicine, like we were talking about before. It's interesting, though, that Sasha brought up Lana Wachowski, because generally when I'm watching a movie, I try not to think about a filmmaker's personal life when I'm watching it, in terms of, you know, what's going on with them. But I couldn't help but think of her while I was watching it, because in addition to all the other themes, there was a strong element of it being sort of a call to arms to be that person who's not afraid to stand up and stick out and do the different thing from what everybody else is doing. And just based on the interviews that she's been giving in the lead up to the film, it just made me think of her. And each one of those stories had somebody in it who did the unexpected thing and did the unpopular thing and wasn't afraid to be beaten back down, because and their actions in turn influenced what happened on down the road. And it just, the more I thought about that, the more emotional that it got for me.
Absolutely. And you know, I was trying to explain it to my niece, who didn't really get it or understand it. And I was saying, you know, in each of these instances, there's some sort of oppression, you know, and what's the oppression in each one, and who fights against it and rails against it, you know. And maybe that does seem lofty and obvious and stupid to a lot of people. But you know what? We're dealing with that today. Still, it's happening in our world right now as we speak. And
well, it's like the Halle Berry character said, like you quoted her before about how we keep making the same mistakes.
Yeah, through centuries and centuries.
And I like the other quote, too, about every good deed we do and every crime that we commit affects the person that we will become in, not only in the future, but maybe, perhaps even in a future life.
Yeah, yeah, I know. It's a wonderful movie. We could talk about it all night, but let's move on to Best Actress. Sorry, it's all weird, hard interruption, but...
That's okay, you got to stop sometime. You're right.
We can't running on time.
Yeah, I'm trying to keep it. Otherwise, I have to cut, and, you know, we don't want to do that. So let's...
We'll come back to it. If we hope maybe we'll talk about Clad Atlas again sometime.
Yeah, it was nice to be able to talk about it. I wish it was going into the Oscar race so we could keep talking about it.
I'm really glad that Ryan liked it. I was worried about that because I knew that some people who had read the book didn't like the idea that it bounced around so much. They preferred the slightly more linear book version. And so the people that I know and love who read the book, I was really hoping that the movie was going to work for them. So I'm really thrilled.
If you read the book, though, you will love the book for its own self.
It will
expand your appreciation of the movie. And they're just two different things. And I love that both of the approaches that they both took.
I figured you would like it, Ryan. As I was watching it, I was thinking, Ryan's going to love this.
You know, that's just all me. I mean, I've always been believed that everything is connected and everything that you do is going to affect. I'm so much into that thing about butterfly wings causing tidal waves and whatever that phrase is.
I thought you would especially like the scene with the sci-fi scene, the scene with which was your favorite part? I thought you would like the neo-soul part the best.
That's probably my second favorite part. Probably I agree with you, though. My very favorite part is the composer and the Sixsmith and Frobisher. That's why I really think that I really do think you can read the Frobisher part of the novel and not read anything else in the novel and just read it as a short story. And it's enjoyable just as a short story itself.
I liked how they had the book by the guy in the other century sitting underneath his piano.
I know, really.
I didn't know.
The half a book. It was half a book. It had been torn in half.
Okay, so Best Actress. We talked about Judi Dench already. Right now it's looking like we have Jennifer Lawrence is probably a lock for a Silver Lining. Am I still the only one who's seen that one, Silver Lining?
Yep, think so.
Okay, so... Jennifer Lawrence is, you know, has had a great year. She's beautiful. She's, you know, a really good actress. I mean, she sort of stands out in every movie that she does.
She's been on the verge for a while, too. After Winter's Bone, she's kind of been on everybody's radar.
Yeah. I mean, if there was any other performance that could take this prize, I would say they could do it pretty easily this year. There just aren't a lot of really strong female lead contenders. So she has to be in the number one spot because of this movie and because of Hunger Games, which made $400 million at the box office. Giving her some competition, though, is the little girl from Beast of the Southern Wild.
Quvenzhané Wallace.
Quvenzhané Wallace, who's really, really unforgettable in that part. And
how do we feel about giving an Oscar to a six-year-old, though? Can we talk
like
about that a little bit? I think I'm the only grouchy one who doesn't think that they should.
No, you're not the only one. No.
Really?
Yeah, because people figure if they're five and six, they can't really... It's not them. It's the director. So I think that's a long shot for her to win that, even to be nominated, because she's so young.
I think, too, and part of it, too, is not only because she's so young, because it's her first movie. And I think that people be hesitant to give an Oscar to someone who you don't know what else is ahead of them in their career. They may just absolutely do nothing else ever. She may never do another movie.
She could be a flash in the pan.
Right.
The previous youngest actress to get nominated for, there's been several that were for Best Supporting, but for Best Actress, Keisha Castle Hughes was 13 when she was nominated for Whale Rider. Yeah. And Quvenzhané is not even half that old.
And Tatum O'Neill was 10 when she won for Paper Moon, right?
That was supporting, though.
Right. So... I sort of wish she wasn't going to get nominated, but, you know, fine if she does, just because I don't want to see her have to lose at such a young age. But, I don't know how it's going to go, honestly. I have no idea. But
I was dead set against it just on principle, which is probably a stupid principle. But then when I really started to look at the possible candidates, it's really not – there's not a ton of great roles this year to pick from. I don't want to say there's not been great performances, because I think actresses do the best with whatever they get. And this year just hasn't been an outstanding year for female characters.
Right. So coming in, two actresses who people thought were supporting are going lead, and that's Anne Hathaway in The Dark Knight Rises and Jessica Chastain in Zero Dark Thirty. So both of them have pretty good chance, I'd say, of getting in. Anne Hathaway is probably going to get nominated for Les Mis, but I thought she was great as Catwoman. Certainly, to me, one of the acting standouts of the year. There's also Marianne Cotillard in Rust and Bone. Seems like a done deal. Keira Knightley and Anna Karenina, I mean, I didn't like that movie so much, but I have to admit that I thought she was really good in that part.
Really? I'm exactly the opposite. I liked the movie, but I didn't think she was the strongest part of it. It wasn't her fault. It's that her character was not as interesting as a lot of the other ones.
Yeah, I didn't like her character, but I liked her performance. I thought she did a good job finding that character. I thought that As watching Keira Knightley, I was impressed with her for having taken that on and done it such a weird way, you know, such a kind of removed, dark, bizarre way. She's such a big star. She's so pretty. I can't imagine her not getting nominated for that, but you never know. Naomi Watts in The Impossible. Have either of you seen The Impossible yet?
Not yet.
No, okay. Thing about The Impossible is it's a true story, and it's about this family that gets hit by the tsunami in, I don't think it's in, I think it's Thailand.
Mm-hmm, it is.
And
it's in Phuket, I think.
Yeah.
Maybe, yeah,
right.
I think.
And they end up all surviving, because it's a true story.
No, that can't be Phuket. I'm sorry. I'm wrong about that. You have to cut that out. Never mind. Yeah,
no,
I'm wrong about
is.
The island.
I think it
it's
is
not
Phuket,
that.
Yeah.
Was it?
I think it
is.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
They all live, and it's how they all find each other, you know, through the wreckage. But the problem with it is, because it's a true story, it's just really flat. The story's flat. It's just A to B to Z. You know, it doesn't have any sort of tension or conflict. So that's a problem. The best performer in it is Tom Holland, who plays the kid. He's probably got a really good shot at lead actor. No, they're running him for lead. He will not get nominated in lead. They should put him in supporting. But nonetheless, Naomi Watts is great in it. She's great, but... And given that it's such a weak year, it's possible she could sneak in. But because it's so linear, this movie, I don't know. And it's such a hard sit. You know, you sit down and you watch this movie about these people in the tsunami. It couldn't be more depressing. Mm-hmm. Academy members, they don't like to sit down and watch depressing movies. They just don't. So that's going to be a tough sell for them. Then we have Meryl Streep in Hope Springs. I think it's way better than the performance she won for last year. I don't know. But I'm thinking now Judi Dench has a much better shot. To take that spot. So that's where I stand on Best Actress.
Going into Best Marigold Hotel, I would have thought that it'd be more of an ensemble piece, but she really is the standout among the ensemble, among the female performers in that movie. I think, and she's the movie is really, she's central to the movie mm-hmm. in a way that the other actresses are not.
Right.
I think she was sort of upstaged, though, in terms of pure flash by Maggie Smith, but she's only her part was a lot smaller, so it's definitely more supporting. But
okay.
I went into it assuming that it was Judi Dench's movie, and I was surprised at how much Maggie Smith there was.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. They love Judi Dench, though. They just love her, and that's a movie they're all going to see. So it makes sense that to put her in, to think of her. You also have to think of Leslie Mann in This Is 40, only because she's going to get a big push and she's going to be in the Globes for comedy probably. So
everyone who's seen the trailer for Hitchcock is talking about Helen Mirren
and
too.
Helen Mirren,
she really looks like she is more the star of the movie than Hitchcock himself.
Yep, she's somebody to consider too. So mm-hmm. there's still a lot we don't know about the Best Actress race. Just that for now it seems like Jennifer Lawrence is in the lead.
Well, like you said, it speaks to the fact of the dearth of really great roles for women this year. That the fact that studios know that they can nominate, that they're putting in lead in contention, like actresses who would normally be considered supporting. They know that it's wide open.
Right. It is. It's wide open. And that's why I wonder about Jennifer Lawrence, if she can really pull off the win. It seems pretty early in her career to be pulling off an Oscar win for this particular movie. Like, she's kind of great in it, but she's also, you know, she's just, she plays a girl who's chasing after a boy, period. So I don't know. Like I say, if there was one better performance, it might take away the win for her, just because the part is sort of comedy and, you know, romantic comedy, and basically her only goal is to win over this guy. She doesn't have a sick kid like Helen Hunt had in As Good As It Gets. She's not fighting for her life. She doesn't have any sort of tragic flaw. She's not uglied up. You know, she's just a hot piece of ass, basically.
Yeah, and I kind of feel like most of the public perception about that movie is predicated on a certain niche of people, film festival male critics.
Right.
You know, and I'm skeptical. I haven't seen it yet, so I can't say, but I'm sort of in the back of my mind favoring Marion Cotillard, who I finally saw in Rust and Bone last week. And she just seems to have everything, and all those things that the Lawrence role doesn't seem to have.
Yeah.
She's dressed down. She gets to be nasty. She's naked a lot, which isn't going to hurt. But it's a dark character, and it's challenging. And I think seeing somebody like her, I think most American audiences are used to seeing her pretty glammed up. Mm. And this is very stripped down and sort of to the bone. So she's kind of got my favorite right now.
Yeah, that's a good favorite to pick. It's also really an intriguing movie, isn't it? I mean, it's moving. It's entertaining. It's not a big downer like a lot of the movies.
It's not, and yet it didn't seem like a fake upper either. It didn't seem to be caving in just to have a happy ending. It had sort of an ambiguous sort of thing to it, and you sort of have to find your own way through it. It was just it's a love story, but it's between two totally sort of unlikely people. And not necessarily always likable people, which can be difficult, but it's sort of about them finding their way.
And and you know they filmed it right around Cannes, so if you guys ever come to Cannes, that's the area where they filmed it, like when she's in the water and stuff.
Sounds extraordinary, but I would say the only thing standing in her way of winning the Oscar is the fact that she's already won the Oscar.
Yeah, that's right. Recently, too, pretty recently. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, has there ever been another actress whose first language is not English, who's won Best Actress twice? I can't think of any.
I think Scott Feinberg did some sort of research on that, and there are a couple, but it's very rare that happens. Mm. It's just a weird year for actresses, and I'm wondering if that might mean that Emma Yatzi Corinialdi from Middle of Nowhere has a tiny, tiny shot at getting in. She's so good, and she carries the whole movie.
Mm-hmm.
It's a long shot, right?
Yeah, but maybe we keep talking about it every week. Maybe somebody will listen. And it's gotten a lot of traction. I mean, it got the Gotham nominations, and critics have really liked it. Even critics that you wouldn't necessarily expect to have gone for it have gone to bat for it. So I don't know. It seems like that little movie that just might hang in there. You never can tell. And I think if it's going to be nominated for something, it's going to be for something like that. I mean, obviously, Best Picture is going to be hard, but. You know, a screenplay or an acting nomination doesn't seem too out of the ordinary, especially in a year which so far at least doesn't seem that strong for women. I mean, there's still several movies coming up that could blow everybody out of the water, but up to this point, it's like we're almost struggling to fill out the five. So why not?
Absolutely. That's the hard part, and so depressing to find that, you know, of those five, by the way, that we're struggling to fill it with, these are all really richly drawn. Miyazi Corinaldi in Middle of Nowhere is a very richly drawn, very interesting leading role. Judi Dench in Marigold Hotel is incredible, an unheard of part to be looking at. You know, this actress, this woman who's in her 70s, finding herself. I mean, I wish I had seen the movie earlier so I could have written about it. I feel like I totally dropped the ball on that. I'm not saying it's a great movie, but I'm noting how original it is, what a significant thing it was that movie made that much money.
it's a better movie than I expected it to be. And, you know, just not – this is one gauge of popularity with audiences. It actually has a higher rating than Shakespeare in Love. I looked at John Madden's movies to see how his movies rank. And people on IMDb like A Marigold Hotel more than they like Shakespeare in Love, which is amazing.
That's crazy. Yeah. How does that happen?
I don't know.
Oh, my God. Is it incredible. Just because they're still so butthurt about Saving Private Ryan?
Could be. I wasn't considering that. A lot of the reason that the score for Shakespeare in Love is as low is because of it's been undermined.
Yeah, that would be like IMDb to do that.
No doubt. I think you're right. That's a good guess. Good theory.
Well, all right. So that's pretty good.
We're going to do supporting actors, too? Talk about supporting actors while we're talking about the ladies?
Yeah, I guess we
can. The ladies.
I mean, there's not a lot going on there in supporting actors right now. I feel like, one of the best performances will be Sally Field in Lincoln. She's so great as Mary Lincoln. I mean, you forget how good of an actress Sally Field is until you see her take on something like that. I mean, you know, she plays Mary Lincoln the way that she's written in the book, Team of Rivals, which is she's very depressed. She's mercurial. You know, she's unpredictable. She's a mess. And she causes Lincoln a lot of problems all the day long, you know. And it's always like, how am I going to deal with Mary?
Oh, gosh.
You don't expect that because you'd think that this movie about Lincoln would portray her as this, you know, peaceful, wonderful, stand-by-your-man type of woman. But she's not. She's anything but that. And she's completely out of her mind. So I think she's got this thing sewn up. But she has a lot of competition. She's won two Oscars already, for God's sake. But
it's been so long, though.
Yeah.
When was the last time she'd won anything? And all anybody remembers is her You Really Like Me speech. You know, people don't even really remember what she was in, it seems like.
Honestly, she has the only competition, and I'm looking over my list right now on the contender tracker, unless I'm missing somebody, unless somebody comes up suddenly later, she has no competition. She's Helen Hunt from The Sessions, and that's it.
Maggie Smith from Marigold Hotel, and Amy Adams from The Master.
Amy Adams
from Hathaway. Anne Hathaway from Les Miserables.
And Anne Hathaway, right. Forgot about that. Yeah. If Anne Hathaway's nominated twice, she could win in supporting. She's definitely over.
What about... I'm sorry.
No, you go ahead.
What about Jackie Weaver in the Silver Linings Playbook?
I'm like the only supporter of her. Like, nobody else is really predicting her. But I think that she was one of my favorite characters. She's kind of the downtrodden background wife. But she was funny.
If the movie takes off, like a lot of people seem to think that it's going to, or at least people are talking about it like it is, then maybe she's got a shot.
She's got a shot at a nomination. She won't win for that. There's no way. A lot of the ones I have on here are total long shots. Like Emily Blunt for Looper, long shot. Susan Sarandon, Arbitrage, long shot. Anne Dowd, Compliance, long shot. Laura Linney, Hyde Park, long shot. The only ones that feel strong to me are Sally Field and Helen Hunt and Amy Adams. So that leaves two spots open.
Anne Hathaway. I keep mentioning Anne Hathaway.
And then maybe Jackie Weaver if the movie's really popular for number five.
Maybe. What about Kerry Washington if Django hits big?
And Harry Washington maybe if Django hits big. Right. And now we're going to give you our selections for great horror movies to watch over Halloween, which is on Wednesday. So, Ryan, you want to start?
Okay. Yeah, usually on Halloween, I like to try to find something that I haven't seen before. And by this time, I've seen almost every classic American horror film, so I have to go look for things from other countries. And coincidentally, there was an article in Salon.com this week that Andrew O'Hare did about a resurgence or maybe a global renaissance of horror films. And right up front, he mentioned a movie called Sleep Tight, which I happen to have seen. And I think that if you have a chance to check it out, it opens this weekend. It's a Spanish film about a guy who's an apartment manager, or he's the doorman. He's the doorman of an apartment building who has a very creepy relationship with one of his beautiful tenants. It's no spoiler to say that, because you find out within the first 2 or 3 minutes of the movie, that he has found a way to sedate her overnight, and he sleeps with her every night while she's sedated. And the method that he does this and how this falls apart as he's discovered, it gets creepier and creepier and escalates into a full-blown horror film on the level of Psycho. I would say he's the scariest desk clerk since Norman Bates.
Wow. Oh, that sounds great. And Craig?
It is really good.
This is just kind of a quick one, and it's been on my mind because William Friedkin kind of had a resurgence this year with a movie called Killer Joe that was written by playwright Tracy Letts, and it turns out both of those guys worked together in 2006 on it's more of a psychological thriller than a horror movie. It gets more horrific as it goes along, but it's called Bug, and it stars Ashley Judd and Michael Shannon. And I think it set the record for the most walkouts, I think, at the time that I saw it in the theater. Mm-hmm. It just was pretty much ignored. But it's interesting. This strange couple is holed up in this motel room, convinced that the government has implanted insects inside of people. And as the movie goes along, they get increasingly obsessive and insane, and it gets more horrific as it goes along. But I brought it up because of Killer Joe, and it's now streaming on Netflix, and I think it would be an excellent Halloween view for people who haven't seen it before.
Wow, that's great.
Did I mention the name of the movie that I talked about? It's called Sleep Tight. Sleep Tight. I don't know if I mentioned the title.
Mm. You did.
Okay.
Wow, that's great. Mine is totally boring because I watch it every year and I've seen it maybe 100 times, and that's John Carpenter's Halloween. But I also I suggest it not just because everybody's already seen it, and of course everybody loves it. And it's like the most boring choice you could pick for a Halloween suggestion.
It's classic, like, though. You know, it's one of those things you can watch it 50 times and yeah, never get tired of it.
For today's suggestion, I suggest you breathe air. That's what I'm saying. Open your mouth and breathe oxygen. That's what. No, but I really do think that there is only one Halloween movie, and I think it's like mm-hmm. watching It's a Wonderful Life at Christmas. I don't think that there's any better movie to watch on a scary night than that. Because totally holds up. And in fact, John Carpenter made The Thing after that, which is a better film, actually, all the way around. And it was totally panned by the critics, by the way, and the public did not go see it. And John Carpenter was almost ruined by the reception of that movie because he really thought people would have liked it a lot more than they did. The Thing is one of the best horror movies ever made. And it's a little bit scary, but it's also actually really suspenseful. And the two of them together, I would add my other Halloween cocktail movie is Carrie, Brian De Palma's Carrie. So those three are my top three horror movies. I would never like suggest to go deep into The Exorcist because that's totally like bummer trip, man. That's too scary. But you can certainly have fun with these movies. Sorry to be so obvious.
That's all right. What I really respect so much about John Carpenter, what we remember, everyone can hear in their head that the theme from Halloween, and he wrote that. He wrote the music for Halloween.
He wrote it and played it.
Yeah.
For both films, he did that. I really love him. I think he's a great director, and I think those movies, but especially Halloween, and not just because it was one of the first slasher movies, and all those slasher scenes are so good. But the best part of Halloween is really the suspense in the beginning because Jamie Lee Curtis is so good and Michael Myers is so scary and the way he follows her around and stalks her in that car and how he's on the lawn and she turns back around and he's gone. You know, those little touches make it scary.
I like that she's strong and she's smart, too.
Yeah. And she's mm-hmm. nerdy.
She's just not a bimbo. Yeah. What do we think about the remake of Carrie coming up? I think that the original is one of the all-time great horror movies, and I tend to be skeptical of remakes in general. But I've got to say, I like the chances of Kimberly Pierce, who did Stop Loss, was it? And
Boys Don't Cry.
Boys Don't Cry. I like mm-hmm. her chances of doing something new and fresh with it. And I like Chloe Moretz as well, even though she doesn't come prepackaged with the nerdiness that Sissy Spacek had, I think she could play it. That's what you call acting.
We'll see about that. Carrie actually in the book is one of those kids that like is so unappealing to her classmates that, you know, Stephen King was talking about it in that book On Writing, and he was saying how there was a girl at his school who showed up every day in the same clothes and had greasy hair and was just mercilessly teased by her classmates. And it's really hard for me to see Chloe Moretz as that character, but I'm willing to keep my mind open. I love Julianne Moore with a passion. She's one of my favorite actresses. She never lets me down. So I'm curious to see her version of the Piper Laurie character, and Kimberly Pierce too. I'm excited. I don't think that they will top Carrie.
I'm hoping that if it doesn't top it, it maybe it's just different. It doesn't have to be the same movie. In fact, we don't need it to be the same movie.
Right.
Everybody loves Let the Right One In. Everyone agrees that it's a modern classic vampire movie, Let the Right One In. And so everyone was really almost angry. There were people who were angry that they were remaking it in English. But Let Me In was a really excellent movie on its own right. And Chloe Moretz is in that as well. And you would think that no one would be able to even come close to the performance of the Swedish actress and Let the Right One In, but she really does. I think that it does the original movie proud.
But now we're going to say goodbye to our Oscar podcast, and we're going to seg into the elections if my two partners are still awake and ready to do this. And if you are ready to sign off, dear listeners, you may do so now. And you don't have
it's going to get political.
We're about to get political, so we're going to leave this on, but you can sign out now. Otherwise, if you'd like to listen to us talk about how we think the election is affecting this year's Oscar race and our basic freak out about the election coming up on November 6th, you can tune out. Okay, guys, so let's talk about Barack Obama. Ryan's saying that Romney's never really been ahead, but he's ahead by 5 in the Gallup polls. He dropped down to 3 2 days ago, and he's up again 5. But there are other polls where Obama's way ahead. And, you know, they can be considered more reliable polls than Gallup. Nate Silver is saying that right now Gallup is the outlier, that is not the one to really believe. And so it's a toss-up, but I agree that in terms of the debate, I don't think that Obama did such a terrible job that, like David Pauland and Joe Lydon, think that he ruined things for himself or the Democrats by performing badly. I think that it just gave the press a narrative to say that Obama failed, and I think it gave a lot of racist Americans an opportunity to not vote for Obama.
I have to say, it seems I feel like I'm repeating myself. Maybe it's fresh to maybe one or two listeners. I've said over and over, and I'm not the only person who said it, I don't see how Obama failed in the first debate. He told the truth. Romney failed by lying throughout the entire first debate. To me, that's disqualifying. That disqualifies you for president of the United States if you stand in front of the American people and lie for 90 minutes. Romney lost the first debate as far as I'm concerned. I know that the narrative, that the media all freaked out, and the instant pundits right after the debate were all saying that they couldn't believe that Obama's not more aggressive. I don't care how aggressive he is during the debate. I care about the truth. I care about a president who tells the truth and someone I can trust.
That's the frustrating thing for me, that instead of hammering away at the fact that Romney basically showed up at the debate a completely different candidate than he'd been for the last 18 months, they just tipped their caps to him as though that's par for the course. That's good campaigning. Nobody cares that he's lying through his teeth. It's that he's campaigning well.
And, it's like strategy.
And that's what they report on, is the strategy. They don't say whether that's right or wrong. They state it as a fact. And I'm not going to go so far as to say that Obama won the debate, because he did not come across well, but I think the only thing he possibly could have done under those circumstances where he was faced with this new Mitt Romney was to play to his base more than he did. He maybe should have been more combative. He maybe should have played the 47% comment, but none of those things I don't think would have really done well in the big picture. It just would have made people who are already going to vote for him feel better.
Well, a couple of things that aren't talked about in the mainstream press at all, because they are totally unreliable, is I heard a linguist on NPR talking about the debates, and he said that the format of those debates, that first debate, is such that you don't confront the other debater directly. You talk to the moderator mostly. If you're following the rules and you're a polite person like Obama mm-hmm. is, you follow the rules and you don't. It's not a debate where you're supposed to. The town hall meeting was more the one where you're supposed to confront the other, but not the first debate. Romney broke the rules, and he directly confronted the president 37 times. And the linguist said that was unheard of. And he said that he said Obama didn't show up for the debate that was being.
Obama showed up for the debate that was expected to be the debate that everyone expected. He showed up for the right debate. Romney brought another game altogether.
Romney brought the Fox News debate. He brought the one that the Fox News audience wanted to see, mm-hmm. and the MSNBC audience wanted to see the Obama fight back to match that. And Obama didn't. He did the more old-fashioned version of the debate, which is you address the moderator. He was totally taken aback by what Romney did. And the audience, it worked for Romney. He got to quote the Constitution. He got to grandstand around. He wiped up the floor with Obama, given the fact that he wasn't playing by any of the rules and the moderator would not stop him.
He wasn't playing by the rules, and nobody, including the moderator, called him on that. And none of the pundits afterwards have called him on that.
Right.
I just hate to hear phrases like he mopped up the floor with Obama. I just don't see it that way. I see that he was an aggressive bully who, like you said, did not follow any of the rules. And he lie after lie after lie. And when Obama would try to confront him about one or two of the lies, like the $5 trillion cost, a $5 trillion deficit that the tax breaks would cost, Romney four different times just denied it and said, I never heard it. You're wrong about
right.
that. So how do you argue with someone who's just going to be, no, I didn't. How do you argue with that?
And nobody's ever going to give Obama credit for having done that deliberately. I've watched the MSNBC reporters and they all say, oh, no, don't buy that. That he didn't do that. He was caught off guard. But actually, Obama is really likes, you know, Reagan, and kind of in a weird sort of way wanted to emulate Reagan. And mm-hmm. one of the things Reagan is noted for, which I learned from watching Rachel Maddow, was he failed miserably on the first debate. But the thing is things were a lot different then. We didn't have 24-hour news cycles. Mm-hmm. Reagan wasn't black, mm-hmm. you know, and Reagan didn't have to worry about angry black man. But what he did was he failed the first debate. He came back in the second debate really strong, and he came back on the I don't know. Did they have three debates?
I'm not too sure. I don't know.
I can't remember. But anyway, that was the strategy. He lost the first debate so that he could come back strong. It's quite possible Obama wanted to do that. I know people are poo-pooing it and saying, no, he didn't. He just got his ass kicked. But I have to wonder if that wasn't part of the strategy to lay low and then come back stronger for the second two debates. It's just that it backfired. Because uh-huh. Obama forgot what kind of people he's really dealing with here.
If he was playing 3D chess like that, I've always suspected, too, and I've always wanted to believe that maybe he wanted to let Romney just stand up there and lie and bluster and bully his way and let people really see
right.
what he was like. No one had really got to see what the real Mitt Romney was like. And a lot of people were really turned off by that. A lot of people.
Yeah.
I don't think that people run to that kind of thing.
You'd think, right? And
yeah.
here's America rewarding him for that sort of behavior. And then
right.
the second debate, he flopped around like a fish on the shore, and Obama completely mm-hmm. nailed him.
Right.
And he did show his ugly side. He kept interrupting. He kept mm-hmm. doing this. He failed at that. I was shocked that it didn't make mm-hmm. a dent in the polls.
I said something today that hadn't occurred to me before. I was arguing with David Poland. And I said, when you and I saw Avatar the first night, the day after that, we were thrilled by it. We were enthralled by it. But a week later, we're thinking, what the fuck was that all about?
Right.
And I think the same thing happened with Romney. I think a lot of people were just excited to see Romney in 3D for the
right.
first time in his life.
Yeah.
He appeared like he was in 3D in the first debate. But then a week later, you think, what did he say? There was nothing there was no content, and then he's empty. It was empty.
Right.
And so I think that can account for the fact that even though he did get seemed to get a 4-point bump in the polls, that declined pretty rapidly to a 2 and maybe even now a 1-point lead. And I just think that a lot of people, it was a new game that he showed everybody, and everybody was excited about it. But then they realized that there was really nothing there to it. There's nothing to it.
I don't know. I'm worried. I look at the polls and I think, I can't even believe they're this close. And if you read, if you happen to find yourself in any sort of right-wing comment board, because we all try to like filter that stuff out from our daily lives, but I did happen to dive into one on Greta Van Susteren's site. I found myself there at one point. And I was reading what they were saying, and some friends of mine who were Republican on Facebook have echoed the sentiment. They're convinced that Obama is finished and that Romney's absolutely has this race sewn up. And they're so convinced that they're laughing at us right now. They're laughing at the Democrats because they think that we're about to lose the election. So I'm worried about what's going to happen if Obama wins to those people. Like, how bad is it going to get?
They're going to lose their minds. They're absolutely going to lose their minds because they are deluding. They're so delusional. I think you're right. They're delusional right now. The fact that, they're in the same way that I don't go to the conservative websites like you have said you've done. They don't go to the liberal websites either. They don't read Nate Silver.
Right.
And so they are not seeing the numbers that we're seeing. They are not looking. They're not looking at the state polls. They're not looking at the way the electoral votes are stacking up. And it's a very difficult path for Romney to assemble enough electoral votes.
Right.
I think it's going to be a lot of shock.
It's very
I think
shocking.
Even reading Nate Silver, though, I'm a little worried about that because everybody's looking at Ohio, and granted Obama has been shown to be ahead there pretty much the whole time,
right.
But he's not that far beyond the margin of error of any of those
right.
polls. And polling, especially at this point, is still an inexact sort of science. So to me, it's just so close that anything could still possibly happen, and obviously the worst could still possibly happen.
It's absolutely too close for comfort, for sure.
Right.
And plus, we know that
deep down, I think that Obama is going to pull it off because of the electoral math. But I still think that it's close enough that that may not happen.
Well, I'm looking right now at the bubble map on elections.newyorktimes.com, which always makes me feel better. So I'm putting right now, according to them, Romney has basically guaranteed 206 electoral votes. And Obama has 243 electoral votes. He needs 27 to win. And Romney needs 64. So let's put Florida over there to Romney, and that gives him 235.
And I think that's probably a sure thing. I think he does probably have Florida wrapped up. Romney does have Florida.
There's a while there where it looked like Obama could take Florida, but that's slipping away. Yeah. But that was never plan A anyway.
Let's give him Colorado. Now he has 244. Let's give him Virginia, even though it's close in Virginia. It's tied and it's close. Let's give him Virginia. So Obama gets Iowa, New Hampshire,
Wisconsin.
And now we have Ohio.
And Obama gets Nevada, too.
Oh, you know what? They've already put Nevada over there. Nevada's
for Obama?
Already,
already
given to Obama.
Okay, all right.
So right now, the swing states they have open are Wisconsin, New Hampshire, Iowa, Ohio, Florida, Virginia, and Colorado. And I just divided them up, and Ohio's right in the lead. So Ohio goes over to Obama, and he wins. But let's just say we give Ohio to Romney. That means Obama can win with Virginia.
Does he need Wisconsin, too?
He needs Wisconsin, yeah.
And he could win – how about – what he could win Colorado. Obama could win Colorado.
Yeah, he could. I feel like Romney's going to win Colorado. You wouldn't believe, like, one of the things that's really disturbing about this election that is not talked about enough in mainstream press is Citizens United decision, which said that anybody could spend unlimited amounts of money to promote a candidate. And they've just, the Republicans have the richest men in the country supporting them. And they've been flooding Colorado and Florida.
And Ohio.
Ohio, of course. But, you know, Obama's got a really strong presence in Ohio. It's harder for them to overtake. It's funny that it comes down to Ohio, isn't it?
It's funny, and it's also scary because as much as Florida gave Bush the election in 2000, Ohio gave the election to Bush against Kerry in 2004. It was Ohio where things were. Ohio was the Florida of 2004.
Yeah. Well, supposedly no Republican has ever won without taking Ohio. So I'm looking at the Real Clear Politics state by state poll. And Obama has Nevada, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Minnesota. Romney has North Carolina. And he's up by 3.8 points in North Carolina. Obama has Iowa. It's a tie in Colorado and a tie in Virginia. Obama has New Hampshire, Ohio. He's up by 2 points in Ohio.
And yeah, that's so close. You know, 2 points is nothing. That's like statistical noise.
No, 2 points is good. 2 points is really good. It's way better than what it usually is, which is like 0.0. On the other hand, Romney has gained a full point in the national poll over Obama. That's what worries me more is the national poll. He's up by...
Yeah, that's a scary thing because I think that the national numbers are going to be really, really close. In fact, Romney may even win the popular vote, but that's not going to matter.
Right.
That's going to make the right wing freak out even more though if the popular vote goes for Romney and the Electoral College goes for Obama, they're going to throw a fit. They're going to absolutely
explode. It's payback time, bitches.
What?
It's payback time, bitches.
Yeah, totally. It's 2000 all over again. Or 2004, whenever the hell that was.
2000, I think, yeah.
We were so mad about
that. Nate Silver is giving Ohio... Nate Silver gives Obama a 73% chance of winning Ohio.
Yeah. Nate Silver is definitely giving Democrats a lot to celebrate. I love Nate Silver, and I hope he turns out to be right. Mm-hmm. I was digging into some of these national polls earlier, and the IBD, which is... Internet Business Daily or something like that,
mm-hmm,
I think.
Mm-hmm. I know that.
They do really well, apparently. Their reputation is really good. They've got Obama up by 2, but Gallup has Obama up by 5. That is inexplicable to me. Because when I look
the reason that the explanation I've been hearing is that Gallup is basing their likely voter screens on the fact they're still basing their likely voter screens on the fact that they think that Obama voters are disillusioned after the first debate. And I think we've all gotten over that first debate. And so I think that they're screening out likely voters for the Democrats, and that skews the numbers.
That they're assuming going to be lower turnout for the Democrats than what probably really will be. And I think the closer we get, the more likely it seems that Romney has a shot. I think that's just going to juice participation on our side.
Mm-hmm. It feels like that. Like the early voting, Obama's way ahead in the early voting because people are really turning out. They really don't like the ugliness that they're seeing in this election. And do you realize, you guys, 40% of the population did not vote in 2008. 40%.
And that was a high participation year,
too. Participation year. So if you can get those people out to vote... you know, you could do some serious damage if you could bring that up to 60%, which it should be, considering our bloody revolution. Mm-hmm. If you could get it up to 60%, imagine what people could do.
You know, my whole connection between art and politics for this evening, at least, is that I've always kind of felt like democracy has no place in art. And I'm beginning to feel like democracy has no place in democracy either, because people are just too fucking stupid and too fucking lazy to actually do to perform their civic duty. And that's why if people would just be more educated and more active, we wouldn't even be having this conversation.
I was about to say, these 40% of the people who didn't vote, I worry about letting those people into the polling booth. You know, if they're not voting if they didn't vote last presidential election, I wonder what it would take to get them to vote and how little they know about the issues.
Well, they better wake the fuck up, because the minorities can control the government if they could mobilize. That's the thing, is that, God, you could do some serious damage if you could get people just to go to the polling booths. And I'm watching John Cusack on Twitter. Mm-hmm. He's one of those people that like thinks that it's pointless to even vote at all. So he's always recommending his fall. Any vote for any of these candidates is a vote for, you know, drone strikes on women and children in Afghanistan.
Like that's the only issue.
Well, yeah. And that's how he sees it. And I can't believe with all of his followers, that's what he's recommending, just a non-vote. A non-vote is a vote for Romney.
I agree that Romney and Obama both agree about the drones, and I agree that the drones are a terrible thing. But, I mean, if you're going to not vote for that reason, then you're an idiot, John Cusack. I'm sorry.
Plus,
you're an idiot.
Obama came in when we were still on dealing with orange alerts and terrorism. There's no way anybody could have won if they weren't a hardcore warmonger that year. And Obama was, and that was one of his selling points. He said he would end the war in Iraq. He did. He never promised to end the war in Afghanistan, and he didn't. He's promising to end it in 2014. I think that's totally fair. Mm-hmm. You know,
I mean, we all hate that the drones have maybe killed 5,000 people, but what I hate more than that is the fact that a war killed 100,000 Iraqis and meanwhile killed 3,000 Americans and cost $1 trillion. Right. If you're going to have to kill people, at least let's do it in a way that doesn't cost $1 trillion and 3,000 American lives.
Absolutely. And the last time we cut and run in Afghanistan, we caused a lot of problems. I mean, we had no business going into either of those countries when we did. No business at all. And Obama proves that. He goes into Pakistan and he takes Osama bin Laden out, and he fights Al-Qaeda, you know, and to me, that's a sign of a great leader. I'm sorry, I don't buy into this criticism that the left and the right have been, especially Maureen Dowd, have been lobbying against Obama. I don't see that. I see a very successful, given the kind of things he's had to fight against, a very successful president, at least on my personal experience of him.
He takes a lot of crap for not closing down Guantanamo also, and because that was one of his big promises. But he tried, and B, all the states where they were going to send these people refused to take them. He was faced with certain political realities, and he's had to deal with them. And that's called governing. You know, you can't do everything that you want to do the way you want to do it. You have to make compromises. You have to sometimes go back on things that you thought you were going to be able to pull off. And in this case, he's trying to win in Afghanistan and get us out without, while causing as little damage to ourselves as possible. And it's not a likable solution, but it's maybe one of the best ones that he's got.
That Guantanamo thing infuriates me so much because you mentioned two good reasons. Number one, he did try. His very first month in office, he tried to close it. And B, no state wanted to have a prison camp for terrorists in their state. And C, the Congress knew that was one of Obama's promises, and they wanted to make sure it was a promise he couldn't keep. So they passed a law when they passed the military budget that year. Part of the budget, written into the budget, was we cannot close Guantanamo. They made it illegal to close it.
Mm. Right. And now even liberals are holding that against their guy, which is just, it's maddening to me.
And most of the major bills that Obama tried to pass were blocked by Republican senators. You know, and then when it turns out that they blocked everything, including, you know, a jobs bill for veterans, which was completely despicable by the Republicans, including that, they said, oh, well, now we need a president who can work with the other side. And as Nancy Pelosi said on The Daily Show, you know, the Democrats worked with the Republicans when Bill Clinton was in office, but these guys refused to work with Obama. They wanted him to be a one-term president no matter what. The power elite really wants him out. They don't like the changes that he's made, and they are spending a whole shitload of money to make sure that happens. To me, it's completely corrupt. I can't believe the American people can't see through it. I really can't.
Well, the American people are not hearing about it. We hear about it because we listen and read the right sites and we listen to the right news channels. But if you listen to CBS Evening News, you're not going to hear this story. You're not going to hear about Sensata. You're not going to hear that Romney, that Bain Capital is closing an American plant and sending jobs to China unless you listen to MSNBC.
Right. And they don't.
The media is so fox-whipped into not appearing to be biased or living up to their liberal media reputation that they're going the other way, and they're being too dense, and they're not calling bullshit when they see it. They're trying to be too fair. It's ridiculous.
There, this false equivalency that both sides are the same, A. And B, what they're realizing is that there is money to be made from the right, a lot of money to be made, and so they are kowtowing. I'm finding more programs like NBC in the morning, you know, their morning show, the Today Show, totally right-wing now. But, you know, I try to find the facts. I try to follow the facts. I don't just go by the propaganda that the left is saying, you know. There are certain facts that are just unavoidable, like the fact that Romney has flip-flopped his positions on almost every issue and that there is no there, that this guy will say anything to get elected, and there's no question about that. So how is it that he's still so close in the polls? And let me ask you one more thing. Think about this for a minute. I was thinking about this today. Imagine if Obama, if 9/11 had happened under Obama's watch. They're totally having freak-out hissy fits over Libya. Can you imagine what they would do? They would probably impeach Obama if that had happened under his watch, like it did Bush. Mm-hmm. They just gave Bush a total pass.
You weren't allowed to criticize Bush. It was unpatriotic to criticize Bush.
Right. Imagine Obama trying to put forth that same, you can't say anything, the press can't say anything.
Yeah,
imagine
no way.
That. It would never happen. So, you know, you at some point you just have to round down to racism, and that's what it's about. It's about questioning his authority. It's about not trusting him in power, which is in turn making people nervous about spending money, which in turn is hurting the economy. You know, it's a vicious cycle. You know, people just kind of want things back to quote-unquote normal. They want the black guy out of office so we can get America back to the way it used to be.
You know what frustrates me is I think that no matter who wins, I think the economy is going to start bouncing back a lot stronger next year. And it's just because suddenly things are decided and a little more certain and money's going to start flowing again. But if it happens with Romney in there, he's going to be the one that gets credit for that. And it's going to piss me off.
Well, yeah, I've heard many people say that Romney's promising 12 million jobs over the next 4 years. Every reputable economist will say, no matter who's in office, Donald Duck could be in office and we could get 12 million new jobs. It's just inevitable that we're going to get 12 million new jobs. That's a promise that's going to happen no matter who's in office. Romney acts like he can do it and only he can do it.
Yeah.
If he wins, it will be suddenly historic fact. And that's just I'm not going to be able to stand that.
I know. I can't abide a Romney win. I lived through George Bush, I lived through Ronald Reagan, and I lived through Bill Clinton, and you know, Bush, it was upsetting that he won, but Bush, even Bush, is a more formidable human being and candidate than Romney. Romney's a nothing. He's a nothing. He's a puppet, worse puppet than Bush ever was, for special interests and the 1%.
He's a tool for the worst people who have done the worst to this country, all the freaking Wall Street bankers who don't actually make anything. They're just playing this elaborate shell game, hoping that they end up on top before somebody notices what they're doing.
And the dangerous thing about Romney is he's shown no backbone. He's caved on abortion. He caved on health care. He's caved on gun control. And he's caved on gay rights. All that stuff he used to support and has now gone out the window, which shows he will do anything to get elected. And he will listen to the people who put him there.
See, I think even caved is one way to put it, but I see that as lying. You know, I see that the man is a liar. That was one thing about Bush. Bush was maybe not too bright. He's not really too sharp, but he never really outright lied about things. I think he was. I just think he didn't know any better. But Romney will lie more. He's lied more than any other candidate I've ever seen. And Ryan, too. Paul Ryan is the same way.
Yeah,
your entire convention was a pack of lies.
And John Dean on Twitter said that Romney lied more than Nixon. John Dean just said that. I mean, it's like, and the more evidence, Obama wins two debates, the economy starts to pick up.
Mm-hmm.
He kills Osama bin Laden, all that stuff. It doesn't change the fucking polls. You know, you'd think that it would change the polls. After that debate, Obama lost his lead, and he has never gained it back in the national polls. That's stunning information.
Well, let's think about who these 45% of the people are, or 48% of the people who are so strongly for Romney. Who are they? First of all, we know that probably a good 25% of the country are racist. There's no other way to say it, don't you think?
Yes, I do.
You're probably being generous, honestly.
I absolutely do. I say it all the time on Facebook, which is like in space, no one can hear you scream. It's like, who cares what goes on there? But I'm just saying, you know, yeah, racism. Hello.
There may be 10% of Republicans who are for Romney who are purely ideologically like the conservative philosophy. More, and so they want to vote for the Republican candidate because it fits their ideology. So that leaves another, 15 or 20%. And I think those people, what else? What, how can we explain those people? I think that a lot of them are really ill-informed. I think that the news does a really bad job educating voters. And I think they're Fox viewers. I think that they are less educated.
Yeah. Well, and educated, Maureen Dowd's column has, she's talking about her sister who's changed her vote from Obama to Romney. Because she doesn't care about abortion. She doesn't think he'll do anything about that when he gets in office, which, oh, yeah, you're going to play with a loaded
Crazy.
Gun. You're going to play with a loaded gun like that? You're going to take that chance when you've got two incredibly pro-life candidates? You know, Romney didn't used to be. He used to be pro-choice, but now he's not, of course. He'll do anything.
Well, when I hear that, it's not as if Romney and Paul Ryan can go into on their first month in office and do something individually to abolish abortion. But the power that they have is the Supreme Court appointees.
Right.
So they don't have to do it directly. They can do it indirectly through the Supreme Court. And that's so simple that I don't understand why people don't see that.
I know, it's so easy. I mean, I guess it will depend on the makeup of the Senate. They will get blocked if it's led by Democrats. But you know, you really want to take that chance? To me, it's absolutely a no-brainer. You know, and I see our country falling into religious fanaticism. It's really scary. I don't want that to be America. You know, I would rather live in another country if that's how it's going to go. Honestly. My daughter, I don't want her to grow up in an era where you don't have control and choice over your own body, you know, and then the fact that the Republicans, Romney included, don't even believe in global warming, that they're absolutely driven by their religious beliefs, you know, without shame, without even thinking that church and state should be separate to them. That's not to the Tea Partiers. Forget it. You know, they claim to be about the way America founded, you know, the founding fathers and what America, they're all about religion, you know, and controlling other people.
In the same issue of Time magazine with Daniel Day-Lewis on the cover, the issue that says what would Lincoln do, there's an article about the election, and they break down where are Romney's greatest strengths and where are Obama's greatest strengths. Romney leads among born-again Christians. He has a 51%, 51-point lead over Obama.
Crazy. Crazy, because Obama is a Christian. You know, Romney's a weird... Romney's a
Mormon. He's not even a Christian. He's a cult. He's a member of a cult.
He came out of the Mormon... His grandfather was like a polygamist.
I know.
Who fled to Mexico. I mean, it's like...
That speaks to what I was saying before about people being uneducated. I don't believe that people really even understand what Mormonism is. If they understood what a Mormon was, these evangelicals would not be in support of Romney.
Well, and that gets us back to the Oscar race. If anyone's still listening, which is very doubtful, but our late night ramblings about the election. But, you know, how do you know it's racism? Well, it's not that hard to do the math. You know, look at the majority of films that are in the Oscar race. They're all about white men. Look at Newsroom, Aaron Sorkin's movie or TV show on HBO. It's about a white man, a white great man. All the covers of all the magazines feature white people. All the characters in primetime television are mostly white. So we are... Racism is so ingrained in our culture. It's a miracle Obama got elected in the first place. And he probably only did because people felt the pulse of history. They really felt like they were making a big change, but now they want things to go back to normal, quote unquote. It's a huge problem in America. It's ongoing. You can see it in Lincoln. One of the most beautiful scenes in Lincoln is when one of you know, that they have that conversation about if you free the slaves, what's that going to do? You know, what about later? Because really, the trouble started after the slaves were freed and during Reconstruction, when rights for the black citizens were completely stripped and the Jim Crow laws went into effect. And that is a lasting legacy in this country. And it hasn't stopped. It's still going on. It's really sad and really depressing, and it makes me sick every day. I have to wake up and read that shit from those fucking assholes on Twitter, on Facebook, on, you know, When I hear about Rush Limbaugh calling Lena Dunham, saying what she did was insulting to women, when he called Sandra Fluke a slut for talking about birth control, I mean, it just, these people are disgusting. And I can't.
The guy who invented the term feminazi.
Feminazi. And these are the people who are controlling Mitt Romney's message. You know, they used to be marginalized. They were marginalized during Bush. But they're not marginalized anymore. They are mainstream. Ann Coulter is mainstream. That's how scary the times we're living in are.
John Sununu is at the very top of Romney's campaign committee. John Sununu has a really bad position in Romney's campaign, and he said that the only reason that Colin Powell endorsed Obama was because he's black.
He's endorsing
another black guy.
And you know why he did that? Because he knows that the racism is working for them.
Mm-hmm.
It's working for them. It's not working against them. You'd think it would work against them. It's not. Mm-hmm. That's why he felt so comfortable saying that.
When you talk about the TV shows and the magazine covers and everything being so predominantly white, people argue and say, well, it's market driven. It's because they're giving people what they want. But, you know, the fact is, black people will watch programs with white people. But a lot of white people will change the channel if there's a black star.
Right. Of course.
And a lot of white people will not buy the magazine if there's a black actress on the cover.
Right. And let's be really clear here. This is an American problem. If you go to the UK, you know, one of the best thrillers in England right now is called Luther. I don't know if you guys have seen it, but it's on Netflix.
Mm-hmm.
Totally has a black guy in the lead. Carrying the whole show. Nobody
Idris Elba, he's amazing. He's great.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. You'd never have that show here. So this is a thing. And you know how all of our international readers, they don't get the whole racism thing. They just don't understand it. Because they probably can't fathom that a country would be this backwards.
No.
But it is. We're backwards. You know, those Jim Crow laws really, you know, generations of black men who were thrown into jail for doing things like walking on the wrong side of the road.
Mm-hmm.
And then they were in jail and they were let out to do free labor, you know, for people in the South. They became slave labor, but they did it through criminalization. So generations and generations of black men being criminalized. Just for trying to live free lives, you know, and then segregation. And then it's only the 1960s. You have to just go back to Kennedy's administration to have James Meredith, the first black student to attend Ole Miss, had to have National Guard troops brought in to escort him in. That was only in the 60s. That's the kind of country we're still living in. Those people had children, taught them their hate, and that is still alive today. It hasn't been solved by Obama. In fact, it's been kicked up. It's been a hornet's nest. And the racism today is as bad as it was in the 1960s. The only thing that's different is that they can't segregate anymore legally. And it's scary. And it makes me sick that more people aren't paying attention to it and noticing it and fighting for it. That's why Obama has to get reelected. He has to.
I think a lot of liberals have gotten complacent because they feel like, oh, well, we voted for Obama the first time, so we're good people now, and we don't have to worry about it.
Right, and we're disillusioned with him, like Brad Pitt and Matt Damon talking about how disillusioned, and even Ben Affleck, which I was so disappointed to hear dissing Obama, you know, that he didn't do enough for the
liberals can accept a gray area. We need to improve. Conservatives don't seem to think they need to improve.
Right.
That's why they're so easy for them to toe the party line, is because they don't think they need to change. Liberals are concerned about what can we do to do better, and conservatives think that they are already doing everything right.
And they attack fact, right? So there's no such thing as fact anymore because the Republicans have made it. I had two different people confront me on Facebook about my comments about Obama's upbringing being a difficult one. And all you had to do was watch Frontline or Wikipedia Obama's life to understand what his life was like. He was born to a teenage mother. He had an absent father. He was raised by his grandparents who were middle class and alcoholic, and he was bounced around. Any kid who's not raised by his mother, you know, is having a hard time, period.
Sure.
And then,
I mean, just look at a photograph. You can find a photograph of his house, and it's a very modest little house that he grew up in compared to the places that Paul Ryan and Mitt Romney grew up.
Mitt Romney and George Bush were born into privilege. Their futures were mapped out for them. They didn't have to do a goddamn thing. Mm-hmm. And for people to not notice, you know, that Obama came from the bottom, he wasn't as poor as Clinton. He wasn't dirt poor. He was middle class. Mm-hmm. But he succeeded on merit, Obama did, and he didn't. Romney succeeded on entitlement. You know, and to me, it makes a big difference. This is America. You know, we should reward people who are, you know, Republicans should reward Obama for having overcome the odds that he did to become who he is. Just like
that's the narrative that we tell ourselves, and that's what keeps poor people voting for people who don't have their best interests in mind, because they think that if they just work a little bit harder that they can be one of the 1%.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly right.
Yeah. And it's a load of crap, because our economic system depends on having ditch diggers. There's going to be people who we're not going to pay as much as we're going to pay other people, because if we did, our whole economic system would come crashing down around us. So you have to decide, do you want to be there to give these people a helping hand, or do you want to just cut bait and let them dangle in the breeze?
That's what Rob Lowe, I actually got into an argument on Twitter with Rob Lowe, just one tweet back and forth, and then he was done with me. But he said something like, Ayn Rand has always been an inspiration. Ayn Rand has always been an inspiration to him, a great motivator, that she encouraged people to be wealthy. And I said, but not everybody can be wealthy. I said, you're lucky, Rob. You are wealthy, but not everybody can be wealthy. And he said, why not? And I said, because it just does not make sense that everybody can be wealthy. If everybody is wealthy, who's going to be cleaning the wealthy person's toilet?
Exactly.
You know, who's going to be cooking for the wealthy people if everybody is wealthy? You're going to import people from the Philippines to serve all the wealthy Americans? This is not going to work. It just doesn't add up. Everybody cannot be part of the 1% because they look at the math.
There's not enough money to go around to support everybody. But also, you know, that's fine for him to say, Mr. White Guy. You know, I don't think people understand. You're Obama. You can't change the color of your skin. You can grow up in a totally white environment with white grandparents. You can go to fucking Harvard. You can be editor of the Harvard Law Review, and you're still fucking black. You know?
That's right.
So, and there's nothing he can do about that. So, sorry. I've had too much wine. Am I freaking you guys out?
No, not at all. Not at all. I'm a little bit wind up myself.
Oh no, Craig's the only one who's not.
What do we got? 10 more days until this whole fucking fiasco is over with.
Craig, tell me that Obama's going to win. Just tell me. Say. Obama's
I think he's going to win. I really do. I just, but
oh,
you know,
don't.
after W got elected the second time, I can't be confident, because that just proved to me that the worst is possible, and it could happen again.
This feels like the worst to me, you know?
Yeah.
As far as Romney being worse than Bush?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Obama losing is worse than Bush winning a second time, for sure.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Obama losing is a tragedy. They're trying to do to him what they did to Carter, and... you know, I just feel like if they say the black guy loses, the black guy couldn't cut it, that forget it about ever having a black president again. Mm. Forget it. I just think it does more harm than good. I also think Obama's good for the country. I really do. I think he's a good president. I don't just think, oh, he should be president because he's black. I think Barack Obama has been a very good president. He's not charismatic like Bill Clinton. He's not a charmer. Like that?
He's pretty charming. He's pretty dang charming when he wants to be.
He's not Bill Clinton.
He's not Bill Clinton charming.
Not as universally charming.
Yeah, right.
No, but they're both self-made men who came from single moms, you know, and they're scrappy and they're fighters. And Obama impressed me so much in that second debate. He was on fire, you know, and if he had been a white guy, this wouldn't even be a question. Mm-hmm. If Obama had performed the same way and he was white, their polls wouldn't even be close right now.
One thing that gives me encouragement is I don't know if anybody watches Jay Leno. I don't, because I don't really like his format of his show and I don't like his style. But I did watch it the other night when Obama appeared on Jay Leno. And Obama exuded confidence. He absolutely was. He was so good that night. And meanwhile, Romney and Paul Ryan have disappeared. They're not doing any more interviews between now and the election. They had Paul Ryan in Alabama today because I guess Alabama's at risk. You know, they have to go down and campaign in Alabama because they're afraid of losing Alabama. No, they're hiding him down there because they don't want him answering any questions about rape. You know,
right.
Any uncomfortable questions, they're in hiding because they don't want to do any more damage to themselves. Every time that they open their mouth, it seems like they do damage. Meanwhile, I just think that Obama has access to numbers even better than Nate Silver. And I think he realizes that he's in pretty good shape. And I think Romney seems desperate to me.
Yeah.
He has all along. All of his flip-flopping, all of his everything that he's done has not been the move of a candidate who's confident in his position. Everything has been a calculated move to try and gain ground when under these economic circumstances, it should never have even been close. If Romney were half of a candidate, he should have been walking away with this because people were just looking for a reason not to reelect the guy in charge.
And also, the economy too was going to be a big problem for Obama. Everybody was looking. It's really hard. I think it's not since FDR has a Democrat been elected when the economy has been this bad.
Right. That's what I'm saying. It shouldn't have even been close at all. But Romney was just, I don't know.
The GOP didn't have any candidates this year. Just look at the clown show that they had during the GOP primaries.
Right. Yep. All the people who maybe would have been good, I think, stayed on the sidelines for whatever reason.
Mm-hmm.
Right, right. But and then they picked a stupid Romney, and everybody said, oh, he'll never get elected because he's a Mormon. But what they forgot was that America hates black people more than they hate Mormons.
And they also forgot that nobody was going to be talking. Nobody has bothered to talk about the Mormon thing at all. That's like off limits.
Right.
For some reason, it's like, oh, we can't talk about that. That's his precious religion.
It's okay to be racist and homophobic, but you can't fuck with people's religions.
Right, yeah. Right.
Unless they're Islamic, then forget about it.
Well, he uses it to his advantage. He says that's why he was serving his country by riding his bike around France trying to convert people to Mormonism instead of fighting in the Vietnam War.
That's so sickening.
I know. He's sickening.
Meanwhile, he protested in favor of the draft.
Right.
He protested, carried banners and placards in favor of the draft, knowing he wasn't going to go himself.
Exactly. That's disgusting. That right there should have. And then what about the bullying incidents of him? I mean, there's these pictures that broke. Nobody's making a big deal about them. Nobody cares. But in Vanity Fair, they posted a picture of him firing the school janitor because of budget cuts, and they put that picture on the cover of the
I heard about that. I thought that must be a joke. I thought this has to be a joke.
No,
this is a parody
real.
Or something that somebody has made up on Twitter. Is it a real thing? They have a photograph of that?
He thought it was funny to take a picture of him firing the school janitor because they had budget cuts, and he thought that was funny, and he put it on the cover of the school newspaper. Yeah, they really did. It's real.
It's very strange when you go look at his history. This came out when they were talking about the fact when he gave that guy at his boarding school a haircut because his hair was a little bit too long and the guy was gay. The forced haircut thing was bad enough, but then it came out that Romney had access to Michigan State Troopers uniform. And he would dress up in the Michigan State Troopers uniform and pull people over and fuck with their heads.
Oh, my God.
You heard of it? You didn't hear about that?
I didn't hear about that, but I tell you, those pictures, those Vanity Fair pictures are horrifying because they're all of his quote-unquote prank.
He used to give him the benefit of a doubt until he caved into the biggest wingnuts in his party. Then I realized he was completely bankrupt.
Yeah,
up to that point, I thought, you know, he's probably a decent guy, but he's not.
If he was, if Mitt Romney was the guy that he was in Massachusetts, he wouldn't be the world's worst president. If he adhered to those things that he thought, but he's proved that he doesn't have any convictions. He'll say whatever he thinks that the voters want to hear.
What you said, Sasha, and what Craig said just now, I was feeling the same way. He's really a moderate. He's really a moderate, and so if we end up with him, maybe it won't be so bad. That's what I thought a year ago. But now we see that he's not. He'll do anything that the right wing tell him to do.
And that's really dangerous because
he's
not going to stop once he gets in office. He's not going to say, oh, you know what, I really did believe in. Because they'll say, we own your ass, sucker.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
You know, we got you elected. You're going to do what we tell you to do. So forget it. I mean, he's a bad leader. You got to admit, Obama's put up, you know, he stood up to some pretty strong forces when he passed his Affordable Care Act.
Mm-hmm.
And when he took out the banks for the middlemen for student loans, you can imagine how pissed off they are.
No, I know. Billions and billions and billions of dollars that they lost.
That's a lot of pissed off, you know, rich people.
Mm.
But that took backbone. You know, that Obama would do that. Mitt Romney's never going to do anything like that. He has no backbone. He showed it. He showed us what he's made of. So I'm going to lose my mind if he gets elected and Obama.
What are we going to do?
What are we going to do? I don't know. I'm moving to France.
That's kind of what I'm thinking at the same time, though. I'm thinking maybe we need to stand up and start rioting in the fucking streets.
Well, I'll tell you what will happen if he gets elected. He'll be out in 4 years and Hillary will be in.
But what's going to happen in those 4 years? A lot of fucking damage. How many Supreme Court justices will he put in there?
You can't undo that. Like if
exactly, that's forever.
Yeah, it's forever. You can't unturn the appointments, and you can't unturn over. Like, let's say they overturn Roe v. Wade. It's going to take forever to get that back again. So.
I can't even say what's going to happen to me if Romney wins. You know I'm going to be devastated. Mm-hmm. I'm going to be wrecked.
Right, I know. He can't win. He can't. We have to do everything we can to make sure he doesn't.
You've been listening to episode 5 of Oscar Podcast with Craig Kennedy from livinginsinema.com, Sasha Stone and Ryan Adams from awardsdaily.com. And we will be back next week with another episode. You can follow us on Twitter at Oscar Podcast or at Awards Daily or at Living in Cinema. And the bumper music today was Future Starts Slow by The Kills and Flowers in Your Hair by The Lumineers.
When we were younger,
thanks for listening.
Everyone was on our side. Then we grew a little and romanticized the time I saw flowers in your hair. See, it takes a boy to live, takes a man to pretend he was there. So then we grew a little and knew a lot, and now we demonstrated it to the cops. And all the things we said, we were self-assured. 'Cause it's a long road to wisdom, but it's a short one to being ignored. Be in my eyes, be in my heart, be in my eyes.